This is an ABC podcast.
For copyright reasons, the music has been edited. To hear the full tracks, listen to The J-Files, Thursday nights on Double J, or head to doublej.net.au and click on the track list at the bottom of each episode.
Kaz Tran here. Welcome to The J-Files, the podcast for people who love music. Each episode is like a quick music history lesson. We pick a different artist or band, we look at some of the most important moments in their career, and we celebrate their impact on music. On this episode, it's legendary Sydney band Sunny Boys. When Sunny Boys splashed onto the music scene in 1980, their impact was immediate. They were tight and their edgy, melodic power pop took the sweat-soaked clubs by storm. When their self-titled debut album arrived in 1981, it was huge. Frontman Jeremy Oxley's songs conveyed male anguish, heartbreak and alienation like no one else. It was a brilliant blast of adolescent fervour with a crisp, urgent, jangly sound. Well, I'm aching for you, baby, but I can't talk to you. You get me so strung up, I don't know what to do. For this episode of The J-Files, we're joined by two members from the band, guitarist Richard Bergman and bass guitarist Peter Oxley, to look back on their hugely influential career. It's an all-encompassing chat covering the soaring highs and gut-wrenching lows, so it's a longer episode than we normally do, but when you get stories as good as these, it's worth it. Richard and Peter kicked off by talking about their earliest musical influences and the scene that inspired them to get into music.
It was great. We had a really good, we got on straight away and we clicked musically straight away. So it was within 6 weeks of actually being in the same room for the first time, we were on stage together.
That is incredible.
And 3 months after we first got together, we were recording at Trafalgar Studios in October 1980. And by the end of 1980, we had a record contract with Mushroom. So it was all good. Quick.
That is incredible. You barely kind of caught your breath or had a moment to.
That's right.
Bit of luck. Also. Right place at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely.
there's always a bit of that to do with it, really.
But, that's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Right people, right place, right time. We had the right chemistry, we had a good sound, we had some wonderful songs to play. Mm. So we were off and running.
All right. Well, we need to sort of delve a little bit deeper into why that chemistry clicked, so instantly and things happened so quickly. And a lot of that is in your roots. I mean, music you were listening to, because, those tastes and that chemistry, they have to find somewhere to intersect and meld together a bit. Mm. So, Peter, could you talk first about your family? What did you grow up listening to, and did you and Jeremy share similar tastes?
We grew up in a small town called Kingscliff, which is not a small town anymore, but Bill, our drummer, Bill Bilson, he lived down the road as well. So we all, from about 13 or 14, we had formed groups with Bill that we played. We played local community halls and hippie gigs. So there was the influence of the sort of surfing culture and the older surfers, who all of them were really into music, and all of them seemed to play acoustic guitar. And so there were these older guys that had formed bands in our area and played shows, and they were writing original songs and playing. So the big influence, apart from, the Beatles and Rolling Stones and the music that the older fellas would play at their parties, there were these guys that we could actually see physically on stage playing, playing music, playing the songs that they'd written and playing in a band. So that was a big influence for Jeremy and I. We were going, wow, we can do that. We could do that. And so we just started doing it. So Jeremy, myself and Bill played together really a lot when we were going through high school.
And Pete's talking about the mid-70s there, like when he was 15,
1973, 1974.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So this is when, this is before the big Australian music boom. This is when the bands from the 70s were bands like Billy Thorpe and Lobby Lloyd and Piranha and Tamim Shud in Sydney and various other bands around the place. You know, it was a pretty interesting time. So lots and lots of hippie culture and small towns everywhere. I was born and raised in Wagga Wagga, so it was the same thing. Small town, it's not so small anymore, and local bands playing covers mostly, and lots of them. And we, us as teenagers, we just went, oh, my God, you can do that, you can do that, you can do that. Mm. Oh, my God. And there was one guy in town who had a Fender Stratocaster, and he was a bit of a guitar god. One.
That's all, amazing.
Oh yeah, and they were very expensive and very hard to come by. I'm talking the late 60s here because I'm a couple of years older than those guys. Mm. So, but I got to see the Masters Apprentices play in Wagga, and I got to see Zoot play in Wagga, and I got to see all sorts of people play because they'd come through there on the way to Adelaide and Melbourne. It was an interesting time, and everybody wanted to be a guitar player because the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Just a slight, ever so slightly influential.
I met Richard.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
I was going to band auditions back in the late 70s, and I went with a friend of mine. I met a guy there whose name was Paul Walton. He was at the same band audition as me.
Waldo, really?
Yeah, Waldo, yeah, exactly. And this band was out in Parramatta somewhere, and we both decided it wasn't going to be for either of us because they wanted both guitar players, but we weren't going to be in it. So Waldo said to me, look, I've got these friends of mine who are looking for a guitar player. Why don't you try out for them?
Yeah.
And I said, well, haven't you? And he said, yeah, but it didn't really click. So you have a go. So I went over to Randwick, and there was Peter, and there was Penny Ward, and there was Michael Charles, and that was the Shy Impostors.
Mm.
And we clicked straight away again, immediately. Right. You know, first day, it was wonderful. God, it was good. And we went out and did some gigs and had some fun. So that's how I met Pete.
Yeah, 1979.
79, yep.
Okay.
And then immediately when Shy Impostors stopped playing, Jeremy had moved to Sydney in 1980, and
right
Bill,
the beginning of,
Bill was already here, and so we said, oh, well, here's our group, and here's Richard.
And Pete said to me, my brother's just moved to town, and I've got Bill as a drummer. Do you want to be in a band with us? And I went, oh, suppose.
So that was it. It was based on the fact that you and Peter just sort of, you know, bounced off each other.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
had a connection.
Yeah, he knew me, and he knew what I played like, so and he figured it was good enough.
Yeah, good enough.
Yeah, good enough.
So that was it. And that was June 1980. So in the beginning of August 1980, we did our first gig with Sunny
that
Boys.
That first ever gig with Lipstick Killers, was that right?
Yep.
You're supporting them. How big were the Lipstick Killers, and what was this gig, you know, what did it mean to you to be able to do it?
It meant a lot because we were mates with Lipstick Killers, or we looked up to them because they'd started in like late 1978 or so, and so we used to see them play all the time all through 79, and they'd built up quite a good following, and they were pretty wild. They were really great 60s sort of punky band.
Mark Taylor's a great guitar player.
And there was lots of places to play, so you'd be out every night and, you know, watching them play. So to actually do our first show is on a bill with them, it was like, oh, yes.
Yeah, and the gig was Checkers, which was a bit of a high-profile gig. I mean, it wasn't just 10 people in a corner pub. It was actually a nightclub with a stage.
Yeah.
Ah, what was the capacity of Checkers?
Oh, a couple of hundred, 200 or 300, I think, something like
that. Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, pretty big for a band's first gig.
It was. Yeah.
We were really lucky,
And we were amazing, of course.
Oh. So what do you remember of that gig, getting up on stage? How many people were there by that time of the night to see the support? And, you know, how did you feel getting off stage? Had you kind of turned them by the end? Were they Sunny Boys fans? Because no one had heard of you, really.
I personally, for me, I have no idea. I honestly don't know, Kaz. I was so nervous and so excited and so wound up that we just went on and played us, did the best we could, and then walked off, and I was still in a daze. I mean, shaking afterwards.
Yeah,
wow.
I can't. Yeah,
you
I
remember, Pete?
I remember we played well.
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of people were surprised by our musicianship because I suppose by then Jeremy and I and Bill and yourself, but not together, we'd played together for maybe 7 years or...
That's right.
Seven or, you know, just in different bands. Mm. So we could actually, I think we surprised people that we could actually play our instruments really well. And and particularly Jeremy, who is still... Oh. 18, you know, and he was just this most incredible guitar player. You know, even now, and I listen to Sonny Boy's stuff, you know, especially our early, well, it's all early, isn't it? I mean,
the recordings, you mean, yes.
Yeah, our recordings are early. But, you know, he was only 18 and he's playing this, you know, these guitar parts that are incredibly melodic, but also very technical.
And, sophisticated.
You know, indeed.
Totally sophisticated.
Good word, Cass. Yeah, good word. Yep.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
The word prodigy has been used, you know, with Jeremy. When did you recognise that in him, Peter, that, you know, he's got way too many feathers in his cap?
Like. Yeah, bloody way too many.
And he was nicely put.
Yeah. I've gotten used to playing second fiddle to Jeremy.
Yeah, me too. Don't worry. So music, you know, like, musically, definitely. Oh God!
But when we, well, even before we started learning how to play guitar, he was an incredible surfer. You know, board rider.
And was he schoolboy champion?
So, yeah, he was Australian schoolboy champion at 14. Yeah. And he represented the Queensland team when he was 15 in the under 19 cadets section. So he was this incredible surfer, and I was a good surfer, but I wasn't as good as him.
That's right.
And then when we started learning how to play guitar, I mean, Jeremy could play bar chords almost immediately, and then he started working out lead guitar parts, and I was going, man, how can he be so good at this as well?
It took him 5 minutes to learn anything. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. And then he started writing songs when he was in high school.
So when we formed out, as soon as he could play a whole lot of chords, he started just writing songs. So it came completely naturally to him just to do that, to say, well, I know how to play chords, I'm going to write songs. So that's what he did.
He just takes that extra step that most of us have to struggle to get even close to, and he just took it. He was right there. Jeremy left enough space for the three of us to create our own parts in those songs, as for me on guitar, Pete on bass, and Bill on drums, because we play the way we play, but he let us be ourselves in that environment, and I think that contributed greatly to the way they sound, because he let me put little things in here and there, and I would do things that were point and counterpoint to what he's doing, and there's just tiny little detail things in there. But Jeremy would put things in these songs, like the middle eight, Alone With You, for instance, is something nobody but Jeremy would have thought of.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant.
It's amazing middle
eight. It's absolutely brilliant. And it's really simple, and it works. And it's just it's like you're taking this little piece of time out musically and to do the middle eight, and then you start the song again, and everyone's happy. It blows me away now.
Come up with that in the studio, or was
no,
that
no, 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 no. He wrote that when he in the bedroom at home, you know, like all the other ones.
Yeah, they're all fully completed songs.
Yep. Right.
What we would do we'd probably rearrange them
a little bit. Yeah, we would.
That our pop sensibilities thought, oh, hang on a second, let's maybe put another chorus here, or you know, let's open with an introduction, whereas the song may not have had an introduction,
and then let's end it like this,
and let's end it like this.
And those sort of details were communal.
Yeah.
But
you're all on the same page by the sounds of it.
Pretty much. Because if it worked, we'd leave it alone.
Alone With You's been covered a lot. You know, it's one of those iconic, classic Australian songs.
Well, Jeremy had written that already when he was in year 12. So when he got to Sydney, he had that song.
Yep.
He had a few songs.
Like, yep.
But a lot of songs were written, most of that album was written here. But he did have I Can't Talk to You from that album and also Alone With You.
Mm.
And Alone With You
prior to getting
to Sydney.
Yeah, the rest of them were written between when he moved to Sydney and when we started recording.
Yeah, I remember coming home to Longdown Street in Newtown and Jeremy had been home because we were living together and he said, "Hey, Pete, I've written this new song and I'm really not sure if it's any good." And he played me My Only Friend.
Oh, did he?
On acoustic guitar. And I said, "That's just bloody glorious."
Yeah.
He said, "Is it?" And I said, yeah, it's fantastic.
Oh, no.
It was one memory.
That'd be right.
Of that period.
Yeah, he was actually quite self-effacing in that regard, which is actually quite a good thing, I think.
It's funny because at the time I didn't pay too much attention to the lyrics because, you know, you're in the band and we were making the music, and it was only, you know, later that I looked at the lyrics and listened to them and went, wow,
right,
these are incredible lyrics that, you know, they're sort of sometimes sadness and frustration about being a teenager, about love lost and, you know, trying to communicate. He wrote some pretty incredible lyrics, I think.
Mm.
And they still stand the test of time, I reckon. You know, listening to them now, you go, yep, that's still how it is. Turn the people around.
Sonny Boy's debut self-titled album launched the band to wide acclaim in 1981. The album was absolutely jam-packed with infectious songs and it's now a bona fide Australian classic. But after the enormous success of the first record, it was an all-too-familiar story of stress and expectation when it came to making their second album, Individuals.
Yeah, there was pressure. And it was funny because I remember being told by the record company that if we didn't go off and make a new record quickly, then all our fans would forget about us.
That's right. And they got us to do it really quickly. And they,
like, because by Christmas that year, 81 and the beginning of 82, we were in New Zealand making our second album.
Yeah.
Mm.
So it was
4 months later.
It was a silly, was false information and it was, I don't know.
They thought we were the Beatles or something and you have to have an album every 6 months, you know?
I don't know. What was happening?
What the mentality was.
But we were quite tired already, and then, you know, there was that sort of a quick. You really need to make a new record because your fans will forget about you, and because we were all still 20 years old, we thought, oh my God, okay, sure,
that's right.
We better go and do it, and of course, in hindsight, it was just a pile of rubbish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Do you have any special moments, highlights on Individuals then, though, that you look back on and say, you know, still proud of that moment or, you know, a song that deserves a little bit more attention?
I love that album, Individuals. I think it's got really great, diverse songs. Something that did happen after Lobby Lloyd had died, this fella found a box, a cardboard box, and in it was rough mixes. There was a master tape, rough mixes of Individuals. Mm-hmm. So we got that and listened to it, and it sort of made us feel better because those rough mixes, you could tell, wow, this would have been an amazing record because the rough mixes were just how we played. The sounds that we got, it was quite acoustic.
Mm.
It was just beautiful.
Mm.
And so what we ended up doing with that, we remastered those rough masters and we released that as, okay, this is what it could have sounded like.
Yeah.
But this is where it started getting really out of control for us, unfortunately, because that album was taken by Lobby to America to mix. So none of us were around. And when he got back, it just sounded awful. So it truly just sounded awful. And we were in Wagga Wagga, I think, Richard, and we had a cassette. And we listened to it on our cassette player and we said, no, this is horrible. Please, please don't put this out. But they said, well, look, it's, you know, we're putting it out. Too bad. So that was really sad.
And it was in such a hurry that the songs weren't the same as the first album songs.
No,
the songs were more introspective. There was slower tempo. They were a little bit longer. There was a little bit more thought in them, a little bit more care in the playing, a little bit more space in between the instruments.
An experimentation with sound.
A little bit, not a whole lot, but enough to make it different. And what the record company was looking for was another one, the same, with all the hits on it again.
Yeah. You know? And the same kind of driving energy.
That's what they were looking for. But that they didn't get that, and they didn't know what to do with it.
Because of that, and because it wasn't a big success, you sort of get less attention paid to you from the record company.
Do you ever?
you don't even...
You're being polite, Peter.
There's sort of, all of a sudden, do we have a record company?
Who are these people?
So it's very tricky. It's the same old story, you know, like this. And it's really sad because as young, you know, musicians and young, slightly, well, naive completely, about the whole business, you know, it broke your heart a little bit. You know, we went, wow. You know,
of course, the record company has all sorts of other acts they're trying to concentrate
on. Oh, of course.
They've got product to sell.
Yeah,
it's a business. It's just business for them. And if you fall off the tracks as far as they're concerned, they're just going to forget about you for a bit. And after a while, someone will go, oh, yeah, what about those guys?
Oh, yeah, they were around for a while.
Yeah, don't they owe us another album?
They had that hit song.
What was it again?
Dig up their contract, will you? See if we can't make them make another record. Show me some discipline.
I'll show you. The difficult circumstances and disappointing outcome of the second album continued as Sonny Boys went into making album number 3. Get Some Fun presented even bigger challenges for the band, and eventually things reached breaking point.
That was pretty hard work.
It was hard work. We changed management by that time. At that point we had Michael Chugg as our manager.
Yeah.
And they got us over to England because I think they thought that we'd get a good sounding record made over there.
Well, yeah, it was just like, how many times could we play in Australia for, you know, around and around and around? Let's go to London and see if we can't, you know, do something. I mean, we did. We played the Marquee.
We did.
A couple of times the 100 Club.
We did.
So that was, you know, there were some great memories.
And Jeremy and I got to go to Paris.
But by that stage, we could tell Jeremy was feeling uncomfortable. He was not happy. Mm. He wanted just to not be in Sonny Boys. Mm. He wanted to do
Had he had enough at that stage?
Yeah.
He found it restricting. He found it wasn't what he wanted to do. He didn't want to play the same songs over and over. He didn't want to have to jump through hoops for the record company. You
know? It's understandable given everything you've been through. So was there talk then that the band was going to have a break or anything like that? What was the feeling?
We should have, probably.
Yes, yeah.
But it was – there was not – it was like at that point, you know, in that era of music was either – you didn't just have a break, you know. Mm. If you weren't going to play, you had to break up.
This is 1983.
Yeah, so it's not like as sensible now where a band can just stop playing.
Yeah.
They don't have to break up. They don't have to do anything. They can just have a hiatus for a couple of years or go off and do a do something else. And
oh, the whole world,
that's actually okay.
Yeah.
That's that right. Word didn't exist in 83, did
no,
it?
No.
It was very, very pop-oriented, and you had to have hit after hit. You had to be like the Beatles, come out with number ones all the time, otherwise you were dead.
Yeah, and you had to keep working, and you just keep working. Otherwise, well, as the quote, your fans will forget about you.
Yes, they won't remember you.
So there was that total pressure all the time. Yeah. And so, but I do remember, at the beginning of 1984, we had... Get Some Fun came out. Mm. We played with the Police, a couple of big shows.
January, I think, 84, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then we started doing some shows for our album, and then Jeremy said, I can't play anymore. And he said, really? I just can't do this anymore. Mm. And I convinced him to do a couple of shows that were booked, and then we just really had to say, okay, because he was really...
He was done.
He was very under a lot of stress,
And if I could ask about his mental health was, bringing out some. It was not something that was diagnosed at that stage, or were you aware?
No.
Okay.
No.
No, we had no idea.
Not the severity of it, and right. we. I mean, all you did see was really wild behaviour, unacceptable behaviour in a lot of times. Mm. But because of the world's naivety into mental health, it was sort of blamed on alcohol or just someone being just not a good person.
Yeah.
There was not thought of, hang on a second.
Maybe he's sick.
Maybe he's really unwell.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
this is the product of his feelings.
Or him not understanding
what he's going
through either.
Well, absolutely not understanding. Mm-hmm. Going, my God, what? And that's why he would be self-medicate. After that, Jeremy formed a couple of groups, but it was a disaster out there because it was just alcohol-fueled horror shows,
He still wasn't diagnosed.
Medicated. There was no. It was just bad behaviour all round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so he came to me. Had you left the country by then, Richard? 87?
Beginning of April. My first of May 87 was when I went to England. Yeah.
Yeah. So Richard had left the country. I had another band with my sister called Sparklers, and that was with Bill, our drummer.
Yep. Mm.
And Jeremy just came to me and said, can I use Sonny Boy's name? I'm going to form a new Sonny Boys.
New lineup.
Yeah. So I just said, well, sure, fine. Mm. I probably shouldn't have said, yeah, sure, fine.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Yeah, but I just...
That's all right. But at the time, hey.
I just didn't even think anything of it. Mm-hmm. Mm. So he formed a new group, but he was very... ill, and he and that group made Wildcat.
Right.
And that came out on BMG, I think. But all the shows surrounding that were disasters, and I had to go to them. I ended up going to their management and saying, you stop this now because it's going to end in more of a disaster than you can ever imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Wow, was it that bad for that you was that to bad. Be that concerned, Peter?
So I... stopped it. He stopped it because I would have. He must have gotten. I must have gotten through to him.
Apparently, you did.
That
yes.
It's not a good idea if you keep this going. So that stopped. But then Jeremy just went downhill. But
he was in the wilderness then.
Finally got him to hospital in 1989. Mm. So that was at least something. So this is real. There's no disrespect to Jeremy. through that period of time, because there was, he was just trying to survive. He was just trying to get through, you know, this terrible thing that was happening with, to him, without knowing what it was and without any help. Because with this illness, you don't believe that there's anything wrong with you.
That's right.
It's everybody else that has the problem.
Yep.
So your reality is the true reality. So it's incredible. It's incredible. So for a long, long time after that, Jeremy was in and out of hospitals, but he managed to be able to survive, and he managed to make it through.
And he mostly did that on his own, didn't he?
He mostly did that on his own.
Yeah.
And he got into lots of trouble all the time.
Yes.
And had to get bailed out.
I've
just heard... through really completely accidental scenarios, wrong place at the wrong time, but just awful situations. And it wasn't until we finally got him into hospital again, and that was when he met Mary.
Right. Yep.
So 2010.
Yeah, it was. Right. Yeah, it'd be 2010. Yeah.
So from
2009, 2010.
From that, from the whole time of 84 all the way through to 2010, Jeremy was just out there, self-medicating, struggling.
That's 26 years.
It's a long, long, long time.
That's more than half his life.
That's amazing. Yeah. Just clawing his way through on his own.
And just surviving day to day, and check to check, and you know, drink to drink.
So once he got on medication in 2010 and with Mary by his side, you know, he kept saying, "Pete, we've got to reform the band."
And Pete's going, "Oh God."
I'm going, "Oh man, I don't know. I don't know, brother. Do you reckon we can do it?" So, you know, we're back to the positivity again.
Jeremy's positivity won out because Sonny Boys did reform and did play together again. It was back in 2012 when a great opportunity presented itself by way of a special invitation from another legendary Australian rock band. After such a long hiatus, though, I just had to ask Peter and Richard if there was any concern about getting the band back together.
Yes.
Yes.
Short answer, yes. Shall we expand on that, Pete?
Yes.
We played it safe because Tim Pittman, who is our manager and an old friend of ours, he was putting on the Dig It Up show at the Enmore Theatre plus other venues around Enmore, and Hoodoo Gurus were going to headline it. And the idea was Hoodoo Gurus invited, you know, all their favourite bands to come and play. So it was this great...
a big invitation.
A big, great event.
Yeah.
And Tim Pittman said, "Why don't you try and play this as a guest on this show?" And we said, "Yeah, that sounds good."
Yep.
But we played under the name of Kids in Dust, which was a name we used to play under sometimes. And so that was how nervous we were. We'd say, so if people said, "Oh, geez, Kids in Dust were bloody shit ass, weren't they?"
That's right.
We could say, "Well, that's all right. At least it wasn't Sonny Boys."
Yeah, no kidding. But Cass, we had no idea. We had no idea whether we could do it whether we could play. And there's so many obstacles. All that had to happen was one person to say no. And it was over. It was off. Yeah? Everybody had to say yes, and everything had to fall into place in a row. That was included rehearsals, they're getting us together at the same place, there being enough money. I was living in Canada at the time, so they had to fly me out. So it's a big risk involved. And we didn't know if we could, we knew we'd remember the songs, but we didn't know if Jeremy would be able to play and sing them with any sort of ability or facility. We had no idea. None.
Yeah.
But as soon as that our first rehearsal, as soon as we plugged in,
remember how loud that was, Pete?
We went, "Whoa." it was pretty loud, too loud.
Tiny little box, shoebox of a room, and there's 100-watt Marshalls.
But it sounded
oh,
like boy. It was yesterday that
it did. Bill and Pete and I had actually rehearsed a little bit, like at home. So as soon as we started the songs, it all just went click.
Wow.
Bang into place. And Jeremy was right there.
Yeah, he was
right there.
Right.
Okay.
He was lucid. He was there.
Yeah. Yeah. And Mary was sitting on the floor of the rehearsal room, sitting there looking up at him, and she had pieces of paper with the lyrics on, and she was saying the lyrics to him while he was singing them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was that sort of level of support. It was incredible.
It's been a wild ride for a band who hailed from the outer regions of New South Wales and took Sydney by storm before firmly cementing in the national consciousness. After all these years, the wins and the challenges, I asked Richard Bergman and Peter Oxley how they feel when they look back on the career of Sonny Boys.
We were really lucky at the start because we were the four people who got together with the right people at the right place at the right time, and that's just the way it happens. It either works or it doesn't for the most part. And we were lucky. We were so lucky.
But we're also, you know, we didn't ever think we'd ever get to play again because of Jeremy's
We thought it
illness.
Was all over at the end of 1984.
So
done.
So it's been, it's a great experience to be able to play again and actually even now to say, well, you know, thanks for letting us play, and thanks Jay for taking your medication, and
thank you,
and you know, and just being able to say goodbye.
To all
the people that love the songs and love seeing us play, and you know, so lucky because to be able to play, it's because we played the last 10 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm. You know. Once a year or twice a year, a little tour.
And we've played at a really, really good level. We've played at nice, lovely shows and lovely support bands, and a couple of places that we've supported Elvis Costello and, you know,
amazing
the Hooded Gurus and what have you. We've done all sorts of really wonderful shows. We've been well looked after. We've been well handled and managed, and it's been a joy. Because we have songs like Alone With You and Happy Man and Show Me Some Discipline and You Need a Friend, I mean, you might think to yourself, oh, my God, we've been playing those songs for 40 years, you know. And I think to myself, you know what? We've been playing those songs for 40 years. We love those songs. They are what put us where we are. But the gift from Jeremy of those songs to us and us recording them and playing them the way we did, that's why we can do what we can do now. So we are incredibly grateful, incredibly thankful.
Sonny Boys might have seemed like a flash in the pan, releasing three albums in 3 years before things got chaotic and led to their breakup. But their story extends far beyond that short time in the 1980s, and their influence has endured for decades. The J Files is a Double J podcast. Make sure you like, follow, and share. Our producer is Gab Burke. Theme music is by Art vs. Science. You can check out Double J anytime on the Triple J app or at doublej.net.au. I'm Kaz Tran. Thanks for listening.